This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. In some ways, the results of last night's primary election in Iowa is a throwback of 20 years. Former Governor Terry Branstad and attorney Roxanne Conlin, both notable politicians from the 1980s, won the Republican nod for governor and the Democratic nod for senator, respectively. The Iowa primary also lacked the anti-establishment fervor of primaries in other states. What does that mean for the general election this fall? It's Politics Day, and we'll talk about that issue and more with Kathy Obradovich, political columnist for the Des Moines Register, and New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson. We'll also take your phone calls and emails. Talk of Iowa Politics Day, coming up after this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aul. It's Politics Day, and it's the day after the Iowa primary, so we have plenty of local things to talk about. We also would like to put it into a national context. We'll get to some other issues as well. Joining us this morning, Kathy Obradovich, political columnist for the Des Moines Register. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, Jonathan.
And we're expecting Arnie Arneson to join us in a little bit here as well. Kathy, the big two races yesterday, the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senate, the Republican nomination for governor, no real surprise. The big names won.
That is true, although I was a little bit surprised that Terry Branstad was down to about 50% of the vote by the end of the night. Polls, including the Des Moines Register's Iowa poll, had him at as much as 57%. So things clearly tightened in the last weekend, and possibly Branstad should have been maybe at the lower end of that margin of error in our poll. But, you know, ultimately it wasn't a serious strain as far as his win.
You know, everyone kind of talked about that race being a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. Branstad, governor from the 80s, establishment candidate, a little more moderate compared to Bob Vanderplas and Rod Roberts, more conservative. Do you think that we learn anything about Republican voters in Iowa based on this alleged battle for the soul of the party?
Yeah, I think they want to win more than they want to, search their souls about, Terry Branstad did successfully, I think, ease some concerns of conservatives without perhaps going as far to the fringe as some of the party members might have liked him to do. He really needed to run a general election campaign for the most part, and that's what he did. But, you know, I think he gave conservatives enough of a reassurance that he is with them on the big issues that he was able to sort of soothe some of those fears.
Well, and most of Branstad's ads and most of his messaging seem to be attacks on Culver rather than talking about Mr. Vanderplas or Mr. Roberts.
Yeah, he spent a lot of money in this primary, almost $3 million. And, you know, you think, okay, he spent that much to get 50% of the vote. But really, a lot of that money was well spent looking toward the general election.
Now, in the Democratic nomination for Senate, Roxanne Conlin overwhelmingly dispatched her opponents. No surprise there
either.
Yeah,
no, not at all. Roxanne Conlin was by far the better funded candidate. She had all the name ID. Once she got into the race, her two opponents, Bob Krause and Tom Feagan, really had no chance to either raise money or get their message out. Pretty totally overwhelming effort by Roxanne Conlin. I wasn't sure how she'd be on the stump, and I think that she had some work to do to really get herself up as a candidate. But she visited all 99 counties during the campaign, during the primary campaign, and I think that has made her a lot better prepared, I think, to take on Chuck Grassley in the fall.
Now, do you think that was do you think she would have done that if not for Senator Grassley's longstanding history of visiting 99 counties every year?
He certainly set the pace on doing that, and he has really a lot of ground covered in Iowa. But I think it was smart for her to do that because she is not really necessarily all that well known outside of really core Democratic circles and especially the Polk County area. She really needed to meet people out in the state.
Arnie Arneson, our New Hampshire-based analyst, is also with us. Good morning, Arnie.
Good morning. I'm listening to Iowa and reading the Des Moines Register this morning, and I'm thinking, don't you love Iowa? It's so practical. It likes experience over novelty. I think it is such, and the irony is to read what Grassley's campaign manager said, where he talked about the fact that Iowans voted for change with Grassley and Branstad, and I'm thinking, whoa, that's a new definition of change, but I like it. It's amazing.
Well, I'd like to let's put this in a bigger context, because it seems like all of the national political news has been about anti-establishment, maverick candidate, fringe candidates, Tea Party, and Iowa seems to have had none of that in its primary. Any speculation on why?
Boy, you know, I think that one of the reasons why is that Iowa is very traditional when it comes to its politics. We reelect incumbents almost exclusively. We are upset. Voters are upset with the incumbents right now. But I do think that they are really also dying for something that is familiar. In the congressional districts, we had a Tea Party candidate in the first district going up against a fairly traditional Republican. It was a traditional Republican that won. In the second district, there were four candidates, and the one who won was Marionette Miller Meeks, who had been the nominee 2 years ago. In the third district, seven candidates from the most staunch Tea Party favorite, Dave Funk, up to Brad Zahn, who had been a state senator and the only candidate who had ever been elected to office before, and Brad Zahn wins. So I think that it's a matter of voters feeling under stress but wanting some sense of familiarity.
But isn't it also, and I'm going to sort of throw out the idea that because of Iowa doing the first in the nation caucus, you have really honed a political skill. You pay more attention. You're a little more savvy. You're a little more sober because you're not as easily swept away. And you also were able to sort of look at what happened in Kentucky with Rand Paul and saw what happened with what was so new and shiny. And that new and shiny also steps into a huge hole every once in a while. So I think that I think it's the political awareness of Iowa, which means that you are going to look at leadership and a skill set and recognize that those things matter. I mean, the interesting thing is that you picked Barack Obama against Hillary Clinton, but again, what you're able to do is distinguish between sort of the idea of newness and maybe really what sounds like a new policy direction for our country. And I think I think the caucus has made you a very informed voter. I really do.
So as we look to the fall, Kathy, do you think any of the incumbents are going to face any real challenges?
Well, you know, there's a lot of ground to cover before fall. And so, you know, I don't rule anybody out this early. But Leonard Boswell is the one who is usually tabbed as being the most vulnerable here in Iowa's 3rd District. He's a 7-term Democrat. And I tell you, just about every 2 years, we hear about how vulnerable Leonard Boswell is going to be. This cycle with 7 Republicans running against him, clearly that was the message. And yet he manages to pull through with handy victories almost every time. He's got probably about $800,000 that he's raised so far compared to, you know, that's probably about 8 times more than Brad Zahn has in the bank right now. And so he will be absolutely formidable. But, you know, in a year when it's perceived to be a bad year for Democrats, who knows?
Well, and I guess, and Arnie, this is a great place for you to weigh in. Doesn't a lot of this just kind of depend on what the economy's like in October as to whether the Democrats in Congress in Iowa or anywhere else really, how vulnerable they are?
Well, it's and I'm actually beginning to hear, I hate to even use the words, a double-dip recession. And, I mean, people are watching what's happening with the euro in Europe, and they're frightened. They're looking at the fact that the numbers really aren't coming in for jobs. I mean, Barack Obama was so excited about the last numbers, but they weren't exciting. Basically, there were all these sort of temporary jobs from the census. There were no real jobs created in the private sector. And on top of that, here he wants to talk about a stimulus. There was an article, I think it was in today's New York Times or yesterday's Times, where they were talking about a stimulus, and the conversation never got to stimulus. It got to deficit reduction. Now, deficit reduction may make a lot of people in Washington feel good, but it's not going to help when you really need to invest dollars to create jobs. So you're absolutely right. It is the economy, stupid. Ask Bill Clinton. He will tell you that. And we really won't know what's happening. And, of course, what's happening on the Gulf just adds to the confusion as to what kind of jobs are we going to create. Are they jobs that soak up oil? You know, it feels like the census jobs. You know, is that the job I wanted? I don't know.
Kathy, what's your, do you think the economy, because it seemed like in every race it was the economy and jobs and railing against the incumbents that were the rallying cry. Is Governor Culver's future based on where the economy is in September, October?
Well, I think that he certainly needs to have some real signs of economic recovery in Iowa in order to keep his job. He will be making the argument that some of the Iowa made good use of the stimulus money, that Iowa job recovery may be better than what we've seen in the rest of the nation. He's certainly making the argument that Iowa has come through this recession better off than most other states, and he'll try to convince us that that was due to his policies as governor. But people are still, to the extent that they're still feeling uncertain, scared, vulnerable, worried about their jobs, you know, worried about the fact that their paychecks are shrinking. A lot of them have shown us so far that they're taking that out on Chet Culver.
You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or call 866-780-9100. We got an email from Erin in Des Moines who says she's tired of hearing that Democrats aren't as excited about voting this year. She's a registered Democrat and went and voted in the primary yesterday. No one's asking her how excited she is. She thought the only way to let them know is to go and vote. Wasn't it just that there were bigger profile Republican races in this primary?
I think so. I mean, part of what's happening is that the Democrats are in power, and so they're defending their position. And a lot of the energy would be on the other side because, you know, it's their job to try to field candidates to challenge. It has been a good year for Republicans to try to rebuild from 2008. The Tea Party movement, the health care reforms, those things have really energized the Republican Party. But ultimately, Democrats still have an advantage in party registration over Republicans. They raised a lot more money than Republicans did in the primary campaign cycle. So certainly by those measures, Democrats are certainly not lying down and taking it.
Well, and the context matters. I mean, look at Arkansas. I mean, it was a mono race in the Senate primary race for the Democrats. So Democrats were very excited because they knew that their vote was going to make a difference. And I think again, you have to look at the contest, not just at the party. And I think that's really, really important as to whether you're going to actually breed the kind of excitement that you're looking for. Contests matter.
And as Kathy, you mentioned earlier, there really wasn't much of a race. Roxanne Conlin up around 80% of the vote. We're going to take a 1-minute break. We'll have more with Kathy Obradovich from the Des Moines Register and New Hampshire-based political analyst Arnie Arneson. More of your phone calls and emails as well. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. This is Politics Day on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. We'll be back in a minute. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. It's Politics Day. We're talking about yesterday's primary election. We'll get into some more national issues in just a few minutes as well. Let's start with a phone call. John from Des Moines is on the line. John, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Good morning. As far as Leonard Boswell goes, that man takes care of his constituents. You have a problem with Social Security. You have a problem with the Veterans Administration. He has a staff that digs deep, and that's why he continues to beat the Republicans time after time after time. He has a history of standing up for his own people.
Thanks, John. We appreciate the call. Kathy, is that consistent with Boswell's reputation?
I would say strong constituent work is really, really important for congressmen, and it's not something that we in the media often see. You know, I think that he does have a reputation for being there, and I would say that Chuck Grassley also is really good at constituent work, has a great staff that way, and so that does really color people's perceptions of their congressmen. They, you know, people like John who just called to tell their friends and neighbors that, you know, they really got answers when they called the congressman's office. Mm-hmm. It makes a big difference as opposed to calling and never hearing back.
Arnie, do you think what do you think is more important to a voter? Whether your congressman's office tracks down that Social Security check that you're missing, or if they vote the way you want ideologically on a big issue like war or the environment?
Oh, first of all, for the 12 people that do call their congressman, their Social Security check matters. I mean, I hate to say this, but for those who call, who need help, that makes a huge difference. And they do have a sphere of influence. You're absolutely right. Because they talk about the fact that, oh my God, he responded. Oh my God, look what happened. I mean, so there is a huge sphere of influence. And that's the power of incumbency. Because those are the opportunities that the incumbent has that the new kid on the block will never have. Because he or she can create a different kind of relationship. So that absolutely does matter. And especially, I think, more in congressional races than senatorial races, because congressional seats are much, much smaller. And those relationships are much more intimate. And you tend to go to your representative and not to your senator when you have a problem. So that's one of the reasons why incumbents do get elected and why they have a vibrant, vibrant constituent service, because they get it. I remember once following a congressman who was, you know, on the stump in Massachusetts, and I'd never seen this before, and he was like running around going, "See that big dig? I brought you that big dig. See that new university? I brought you that university." And so that was his, you know, global constituent service, but the crowd went nuts. You know, it was like, "Oh yeah, oh yeah," as if somehow he was like, you know, totally responsible. I do in the end think it matters, and that's another reason why incumbents win. And the media doesn't pay attention to that, because I don't call you after I talk to my congressman, because I don't know you, Mr. or Miss Reporter, but I do know my neighbors, and I talk to them, and incumbents get it, because those neighbors vote.
Let's go to the phones. Danielle from Woodward is on the phone. Danielle, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I am concerned. I'm not thrilled with either Culver or Branstad, but I'm remembering the flood of 93, and I think Branstad's feeble response. He did not set things in motion that addressed ecological integrity or how we do farming, and I think Culver did a better job in putting us on a better footing, looking at the potential for future floods, since we know Iowa will be 19% wetter. And I'm also really distressed about Helen Thompson. I think men get away with verbal gaffes, and the world came down on Helen Thompson. And if
Helen Thomas?
Helen Thomas, yes, thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Okay.
And if she's gone, Arnie, I don't think anyone else but you would hold all presidents accountable for the way they do business. So
the problem with Helen was she was egged on, and I know what she was thinking,
yes,
but I know how it came out.
Yep.
And she was sort of reminding the Israeli that, you know, you fled what you thought was home, which was Germany and Poland, and now you're asking the Palestinians to leave what they think is their homeland. And she could have done it in a more subtler way, but that's never been Helen's way. It's never been Helen's way. And I want to remind everyone, I'm glad you brought up Helen Thomas. Helen Thomas is now an opinion journalist. She is no longer a reporter per se. Hasn't she been moved into the opinion section? And so I just think if she were just a raw journalist, you might be offended. But when I hear some of the things coming out of Fox and some of the things coming out of some of the opinions on some of the other shows, those opinion people say some pretty, pretty vile things
about
me, and they maintain their position, and nobody forces them out, no matter how old they are.
And many of them are men, so I do think there's a gender component to this as well.
Thanks for your call, Danielle. Let's speaking of gender, one other topic I want to get to, and that is that last night in her acceptance speech, Roxanne Conlin made reference to the fact that Iowa and Mississippi are the only two states that have never elected a woman to Congress, the Senate, or the governor's mansion. And this certainly isn't the first time that we've been reminded of this, and I don't think anyone in the state of Iowa is particularly proud of that designation. However, do we think that's going to play any role at all in the perception of the candidates in the fall election, Kathy?
Well, I think that if that was the main thing that people were going to base their votes on, Hillary Clinton would have been the winner of the Iowa caucuses and would have gone on to win Iowa possibly in the general election. She actually, you know, really made a point of hitting that when she was here. I do think that probably Roxanne Conlin is going to be courting women voters and that she has a real opportunity for women to get women voters, but not only just talking about the glass ceiling, she's going to have to be talking about the issues that really women voters are going to care about, including education, including the strong economy, pocketbook issues, and including other sort of civil rights and gender issues.
Arnie, do you think that that electing someone on that factor is much of a factor?
Well, first of all, Roxanne, don't talk about being a female. They noticed. They know. You don't have to mention. If somebody else wants to say that we have never elected a woman, you know, Mississippi and Iowa, let someone else say it, but not you, because you are not running as a woman to be the next U.S. senator. You are running because you are the better candidate or the best candidate, whatever the rationale is. You bring your history, your integrity, your articulateness. But the fact that you're female, we notice. You know, and I think in the end, a lot of women won yesterday, but it wasn't because they were female. I think they were able to either market themselves as the better candidate, the better campaigner. They were able to outspend their opposition. Let me point you to California, because the two women that were running were willing to spend gobs and gobs of money. They could have feed millions, but they chose to instead feed the media. But I mean, so I think that's not necessary. What Roxanne is going to have to prove is why she will be better for Iowa than Grassley. That's her task. And if she's female and she wins, then guess what? The record is broken. And if she loses, it's because she wasn't the better candidate, not because she was female.
One last question for you, Kathy, before you have to go and we have to take a break. Same-sex marriage, a lot of people thought that some of these primaries would be a referendum on it that would be the big issue. The big opposers of that did not win in just about any primary, including some state house races where very well-funded opposition to same-sex marriage did not win in their primaries. Do you think the same-sex marriage issue is going to be an issue in Iowa in the fall election?
I think it is going to be an issue in the fall election. You know, people like to say that something is going to be a referendum on an issue until they lose. And, you know, they don't want to drop the issue just because they've lost in the election. The fight about this is going to go on. In the governor's race, Terry Branstad has been publicly on the record saying he would support a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. Chuck Culver is on the other side. So this debate will continue as being a difference between the candidates in the general election. In the primary, however, it was candidates attacking Terry Branstad from the right, saying he wouldn't go far enough to stop gay marriage in Iowa. You know, he sort of preserved a position where he would let the voters decide, but he wasn't going to take unilateral action as the governor to try to make something happen.
Do you think that this is going to be one of the big issues, though?
I don't think so. I think it really goes back to the economy. And one of the things that we saw even before the governor's race started was efforts by Republicans to cast this race as a fiscal issues versus social issues. Terry Branstad really kept it focused on fiscal issues and pulled out the victory that way. I see that going forward into the fall campaign.
Kathy Obradovich from the Des Moines Register, thank you for joining us.
Thanks,
appreciate
Jonathan.
Having you on. We're going to take a break for news. When we come back, Arnie Arneson will stay with us and we'll turn our attention to more national issues, including talking about the oil leak that persists in the Gulf and all of the politics that are surrounding that. That's coming up after the news here on Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. It's Politics Day. Arnie Arneson, our New Hampshire-based political analyst, is with us for the rest of the hour. I'm going to turn a little bit of our attention to more national issues. We'd also like your phone calls and emails, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. So, Arnie, it seems like the oil leak in the Gulf is continuing to go, and nobody seems to be coming out looking very well in this situation.
Well, because no one did anything very well. The regulators didn't regulate. BP cut corners. People didn't respond in a maybe visual way, forcefully enough, as if somehow, you know, screaming on day two would make the situation on day 40 any better than it is today. It is a disaster, but I don't know if I sent you this article. It was almost like, I said to someone, it sounded like The Onion, you know, Barack Obama maintains his resolve, continues to open up the possibility of drilling or something like that. It was like, again, we don't know how to respond because we're desperate for oil, because we haven't done the conservation, because we haven't looked at alternatives. And yet when we're desperate for oil, we're willing to sort of look the other way as what are the consequences. We never do the cradle to grave analysis of things like oil or coal or nuclear. What we do is we say we want it and we want it now. And it's horrific. It's horrific. It's about an economy. It's about a way of life. It's really about our future. And it's so much worse than anything we could have imagined, because Katrina we could recover from. This, I hope my grandchildren will be able to say we recovered. That's how I feel, and that's a very, very frightening scenario.
What's your assessment of President Obama's performance and what the long-term political ramifications might be for him?
Here's the pathetic thing. I don't know what we know that's more sophisticated than what the oil industry knows. In fact, we have always relied on the oil industry to tell us what to do, how to do it, to trust them. So then the question becomes, what does he do? And that's why I was talking before a little bit about, you know, the question of whether we should rethink the stimulus. I think there's an irony here that they want to talk about deficit reduction when, in part, in order to do cleanup, you are going to have to create almost a cleanup stimulus, Jonathan. You really are. You don't care what the deficit is going to be. You have to address the cleanup, because the cleanup is about how many states along the coast. And the reason why this is different is people are saying, well, it hasn't happened inland. It's not going to touch Iowa. Here's the sort of interesting thing. Everybody visits the Florida coastline. You know, we all go to Disney World. You know, we all go to the beaches there. Everyone has a sense. I mean, because we all tend to visit those places in Mississippi and in Louisiana, because it is our coast, it is not the coast of the southern part of the country. It is our collective coast. And I think that there is a sort of a collective acceptance that this is much more real and much more present in everyone's consciousness. I don't think this is going to disappear from the headlines. So is it going to be a problem for Barack? It is going to be a problem for Barack because it happened on his watch. But it is a problem for all of us, because we have all collectively turned the other way when it came to our responsibility to recognize the consequence of our incredible addiction to oil. We have 5% of the world's population. We use up 25% of the world's resources when it comes to energy. Outrageous.
However, we do have a long history of when something catastrophic happens, that's when real reform takes place. Are you trying to contain the leak is one issue, because you know, I'm not sure even if you deployed all of the resources in the entire world to that leak that you were going to stop it any quicker than it had been. But are you saying that no one will take this seriously and do the things that need to happen to reform offshore drilling in the future?
Well, let me give you an example. I do think that you're seeing certain change in behavior, or at least the idea that I just sent an article out, and the article was 10 states joined WIN consortium. And it turns out that the governors of 10 East Coast states have joined federal authorities to promote the development of offshore wind energy. Now, I want to remind everyone that includes the state of Massachusetts, New Hampshire, you know, Maine, Vermont, whatever it is. And I'm laughing in a way because this is the same place where Cape Wind, that notorious offshore wind turbines off the coast of Cape Cod, went through such a horrific, you know, series of stoppages by people like the Kennedys and everything else in order to get permitted to have this offshore. So what this has done, at least on the East Coast, has gotten a lot of governors to say, okay, we're going to own our energy answer. We are now going to promote and work together to produce more opportunities for wind. So is there a reaction? Yeah, that's an interesting reaction. But even as I talk about the 10 governors and the 10 states embracing wind, I will point to my own state. The state of New Hampshire is just about to walk away from this regional greenhouse gas initiative. There's a dozen states that got in that sort of started their own sort of cap and trade. And one of the rationales for this was that the money that we were going to get from it, we were going to then invest in alternative energy, in conservation, and so we were going to encourage our states to behave differently when it came to our relationship with energy. We are so desperate for dollars, Jonathan, and we don't have the inclination to look at tax reform or to raise taxes that they're about to tap this money that just came down for the first time ever last year that was totally going to be devoted to energy and conservation, and they're going to use it possibly to balance the budget. These are the kind of Sophie's choices that governors, members of Congress are making. They're making a short-term answer that will affect a long-term solution. That's what's so sad. That's what's so sad about this.
If we can change gears just a little bit and go back to some election issues, not in Iowa but across the country, yesterday was the primary day in many states. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader in Nevada, was considered incredibly vulnerable. Was perceived to be. However, the Republican voters in Nevada chose Sharron Angle to be their nominee, whose opinions include phasing out Social Security and eliminating the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. Clearly, this didn't happen in Iowa, but in Nevada, we're looking at a candidate that was very much buoyed by the Tea Party and more conservative members of the party.
Well, she was also employed by the Club for Growth, too. See, mm-hmm. We also have to look at this because she's an interesting candidate because there was a moderate Republican who was clearly not part of the Tea Party ilk, but I think at one point in time may have embraced some kind of, you know, tax reform or balanced budgets or whatever. So not only did the Tea Party candidate win, but the Club for Growth also invested in her and she won. I think the problem is that not only is Reid the happiest camper now because this is like a gift from God from his perspective, because when you play out all the things that she embraces, many independents and people who don't necessarily see themselves as aligned with either party are going to feel very, very uncomfortable with her in the U.S. Senate. So Reid has really been given an opportunity I think he never thought possible, and he has to thank Republicans for it and not his own party.
So if Harry Reid wins re-election and is still the Senate Majority Leader, do people around the nation have Republican voters in Nevada to thank for it?
Well, I don't know whether he maintains his status as the Majority Leader because, again, you have a number of other Senate races around the country that are going to change. I mean, Barbara Boxer is in the worst fight of her life. I mean, Barbara Boxer has been a candidate who has been given a gift every single time she's run for election. This time, she is not being given a gift. She has been given probably one of the most well-funded, personally funded candidates in U.S. history who will go into her personal checkbook and write as many checks as she needs to win. She is articulate. She is a former CEO. I mean, she will be a formidable candidate, and Barbara has never been the strongest candidate. So again, it's not just Reid winning in Nevada that's going to make the difference. You have to look at the rest of the country, because there are a number of very provocative races around the country that could change the balance in the Senate.
Absolutely. Another election topic, and we talked about this related to Iowa a little bit earlier, about women. The headline on NPR.org is, for politics, is a Super Tuesday for women nationwide. And they talk about how well women did in some of these other states, and how strong their prospects are for the fall. Does that put an exclamation point on the issue in a state like Iowa or Mississippi, or do we still, well, is that not an issue?
No, let me give you an example. We have to look at some of the women that won. Again, I think here's the good news. Women won, but they won for interesting reasons. The women that won in California outspent everyone. So they were able to do what men had historically been able to do, go into their personal checkbooks and buy an election. I mean, I introduce you to the mayor of New York City. I mean, Bloomberg wasn't even a Republican like 14 hours before he ran for mayor. I mean, he could switch parties and then spend an unlimited amount of money to win an election. So women are winning, or are possibly going to be up, you know, on the ballot in November, in part because they're doing what, you know, both, you know, what men have had the capacity to do for a lot of long time, and that is be able to write checks. But then let me go to the state of Maine, because the state of Maine is the exact opposite of what happened in California, with two women who, you know, one of them who I think rarely even voted was able to win her nomination. But in the state of Maine, Libby Mitchell is 69 years old. She is the first woman in U.S. history to serve as a Senate president and the Speaker of the House, and she won her primary to run for governor in the state of Maine using public campaign financing. Now, that's a girl I like. I mean, but so look at this. She had experience. She had history. All those things that men have been able to bring to the table that women rarely were able to bring to the table because they hadn't been on the bench long enough. So what you get with a Libby Mitchell in the state of Maine is what historically men have been able to do. Look at, I've been your president of the Senate. Look at, I've been your Speaker of the House. Look at my history. Look at my maturity. And Libby has what men have had. And that isn't about sex. It really is about experience. And so I think that's why it is maybe the year of women, but it's because women now have history. Women now have access to cash. People are looking for change, and they probably can package their sex and create the idea of change, but they also bring a lot more to the table.
Speaking of women, what's your take on Blanche Lincoln? Everybody thought that she was very vulnerable, that she would not win the runoff election, but she did.
Oh, God, Jonathan. I know Blanche. Let me tell you how. In 1992, which was the first year she ran for Congress in Arkansas, that was the year that I ran for governor in the state of New Hampshire, and I was the darling of the Women's Political Caucus. And so at the end of the election, Blanche wins, Arnie loses. And they invite Blanche and Arnie back to the Women's Political Caucus, and Blanche represents all the winner women, and I represent all the loser women, okay? And it was so interesting because I'm listening to Blanche as she packaged herself in this ferocious Senate primary, and she packaged herself as kind of an old girl of Arkansas. I'm one of you. I eat your possum. I've been around. I may have made mistakes, but I'm one of you. And in 1992, when she was explaining to these women how she won in Arkansas, she said exactly the same thing. She has always run as kind of an old girl from Arkansas, and that's really even how she packaged herself at the very end. One of the things I will say for her, however, is that she also packaged herself as a Democrat, and if there's a reason for me to be happy about this race and her winning her primary, is that she is the one that has put in that very, very strong regulation regarding derivatives and the banking community. Legislation that bankers absolutely, totally hate. And the fact that she managed to sort of squeak through and win her primary means that that derivative legislation may actually see the light of day. If she had lost, it probably would have disappeared.
Speaking of women, let's go to one more topic. Elena Kagan's nomination hearings have been scheduled. They're going to start in about 3 weeks. Her nomination was made, talked about it for a little bit, completely fell off the headlines between the flotilla in Gaza, the oil spill, the Korean sinking boats. That is this going to come back, and is it going to come back in a big, bad way, do you think?
No. I mean, there's, you know, this is, I mean, it sounds awful, but I was, I don't know if I said this last week on the news on Talk of Iowa, but I was commenting on the fact that I am so frustrated that the liberals on the bench, the David Souters, the Kagans, the Sotomayors, or at least those that have been appointed that we think will be more liberal than the Thomases and the Roberts, that my frustration is that they're all single individuals. And I'm looking at Justice Thomas's wife, who sort of, you know, plays with the Tea Party. I'm looking at Scalia's son, who is the attorney for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And I keep thinking, boy, you know, those guys have conflicts and they never recuse themselves. And here we have these single individuals that we appoint to the bench that will never have a conflict because their family members don't exist, you know. I think that Elena Kagan is a very, very smart, competent woman. I think she's not going to be the issue. There are too many other issues. If Republicans want to make hay, they're not going to make hay with her. You know, she's not going to change the balance on the bench. So therefore, why waste the political capital?
Earlier, we were talking about Helen Thomas, and we had to shift gears real quick because to make the most of Kathy's time. But do you have any additional reflection on that? That is at some level an end of an era, but possibly kind of a besmirched end of an era.
Oh, Helen, if I could take those words and shove them back into her mouth, but in some ways maybe that's how Helen had to go. She has always been. How do I say this? There's a show on the BBC called Hard Talk, and I recommend that people listen. We want our reporters to not be as aggressive as they need to be, and that doesn't mean that I always agree with Helen, and sometimes I think she's inappropriate. But the one thing I don't want from reporters and from commentators is I don't want them to be stenographers to power. And unfortunately, one gets the feeling, and we're going to get it even more now because there are fewer and fewer reporters because of consolidation, because of the challenge to the media. You hear Washington Post selling Newsweek. Horrific possible result. And that means that sometimes we're going to have reporters who are going to say and ask questions that we abhor. But in a democracy, guess what? We need people to say things that make us uncomfortable because you know what? Politicians that make mistakes, that hide things under the rug, they do more than make things uncomfortable. They make mistakes, big mistakes. And that doesn't mean that I agree with what Helen said, because what Helen did was make two wrongs don't make a right. And Helen was wrong, you know. And even if you think that the Israelis are wrong vis-a-vis Gaza and the Palestinians, it's, you know, you don't trump it with another wrong.
Do you think that's
the frustrating thing I have with Helen.
Do you think that one comment damages more than 60 years of reporting that Helen Thomas did? Does it bring all of it into question?
No. Helen's a tough broad. She went out in a way that people will remember. She didn't disappear and crawl under a rug and walk away. And what can I tell you? I remember when they removed Helen from her front seat as the dean of the press corps, and I remember a lot of reporters moaning and groaning about, wasn't this horrible? How could the Bush administration have done this to Helen? You know, they sent her basically to the back of the room, and I said, well, you know what? I said to one of the reporters, you could have changed that. If you were angry with what they did and how they treated Helen, then instead of letting Helen go to the back of the room, all those reporters should have stood up and walked behind Helen and sat behind her. I said, you know what? We're collective sheep. You know, every once in a while you have to stand up. And unfortunately for Helen, it was inappropriate words maybe with irrational sentiment, but at her age and given her spunk, she says things that she regrets, but she continues to say them anyway.
So if it's not a requiem for her career, is it a requiem for a style of journalism?
Well, I think there are very few. There are no other Helen Thomases. There is no one that holds our people accountable. There is no one who, when a reporter asks a question and then the candidate changes the question and frames it in the way he or she prefers, the reporter doesn't say, "That's a lovely answer, but not to my question." You know, I mean, we need people like that. We need people who just say the uncomfortable all the time, because ultimately that's how we find out the truth. You know, remember how we love what happens in the question section in the Canadian Parliament or in British Parliament, where it gets so raucous and obnoxious things are said? Well, they have it twice. They have reporters who ask the tough questions, and they permit the tough questions to be even asked in their parliamentary proceedings. We are too nice. And what do we get for it? We get the Mineral Management Service. We get BP. You know, we get things that I think are corruption that we could have actually tackled if we were willing to accept the hard questions.
Arnie Arneson, thanks as always for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Jonathan. Take care.
Before we go, we just have a quick note. This just in, Michael Kiernan is resigning as the chairman of the Iowa Democratic Party. There will be a news conference this afternoon. Apparently, he's leaving because of personal reasons, but no additional information has been released at this point. Michael Kiernan, again, resigning as the chairman of the Iowa Democratic Party. Press conference today at 2 o'clock. The Democratic State Central Committee will hold a special meeting Thursday night to vote on a new chairman. That's it for Talk of Iowa this week. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and John Pemble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.